The GP Plus Careers Podcast.
Are you a GP hoping to diversify your career? Perhaps you've got a passion for women's health or have ambitions to be an expedition GP. Or maybe you've just always wondered, what would it be like to be a GP working in a prison? Well, this will hopefully be the podcast for you. My name's Sophie Lumley. I'm a First 5 GP in the West Midlands and also a training programme director. I certainly fell into the above category, and I was keen to start this podcast to find out about the breadth of career options available to me, my colleagues and my trainees. I've been lucky enough to interview fellow GPs who've had some of these extra roles. They've told me what their role involves, how they got there, and the tips and advice that they have for those hoping to follow in their footsteps. I really hope you enjoy listening and feel as inspired as I have in speaking to them. So I'm really pleased today to be joined by Justine Demink, who is a GP, but also a medical examiner. And I'm really excited about this one. It's a relatively new role for GPs, and I'm sure lots will be interested in how you came to have this role and how they might be able to get into it. So over to you, Justine. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
I'm a GP partner 6 sessions a week in an urban practice in Bristol, and one day a week I do a session as a medical examiner. And I've been doing the medical examiner role since October 2022. And I've been a GP partner in the practice I'm in since 2011. I basically, on a Monday, I do my ME session. And my GP sessions are Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, full days. And I don't know how much people know about the medical examiner service. They might not have had to do a death certificate since the service became statutory a year ago. But the medical examiner service looks at all deaths that aren't automatically referred to the coroner. And this is all deaths, so deaths that occur in the community and in secondary care. In Bristol, the service had been running for a number of years in the hospital trusts. And when I first started the role, it was a hospital-based role. And then as the community work stream developed about 18 months ago, I've been doing that full-time. As my primary work stream. I very occasionally do a session cover in the hospital now.
And how does that work in terms of which deaths you're reviewing and how it's divvied up between primary and secondary care? So if you were based in secondary care before, is it now that you're just reviewing community deaths? And how does the work get divided up? What does your Monday morning look like?
So in Bristol, in a year, we have about 8,400 deaths, and there's a 50-50 split between deaths in hospitals and deaths in the community. So community includes obviously people who die at home, care homes, the hospice. And in Bristol, we've got, in our region, we've got adult and child hospice. Also, mental health units fall under the community work stream. The MOD in Bristol and the private medical facilities. So thankfully we haven't had any, as far as I know, from some of those sort of people that fall under our remit. So our main, obviously, focus is people who die at home, people who die in hospice, and people who die in care homes. We also scrutinise any deaths for people who are in the sort of step-down care facilities, rehabilitation units, that sort of thing. And so when I get into the office, the first thing I start to do is countersign death certificates. So each death certificate has a signature from the person who's an attending practitioner, and then there's a procedure where the medical examiner countersigns it once it's all been agreed, and at that point it gets sent across to the registrar by our office. So there's no more paper, as in the family doesn't take the death certificate to the registry office anymore. Although the paper still exists, which is something I'll come on to later, we have to scan it and deal with it as an electronic document from that point. So scanning, countersigning the death certificates, depending on how long how many there are, somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes. And then I will have a look at my diary that the medical examiner offices have allocated cases to me for that day, checking to see if there are any that are for urgent release. So that would be faith deaths, deaths of children, which are thankfully quite rare, brain donation, organ donation, and people who'd want to donate their body to medical science. So we tried to prioritise people who need to go through the process more quickly as best we can. And then I get on with all the other cases. So it's a 4-hour session, and I probably do, depending on the complexity and the overall workload, somewhere between 8 and 12, maybe 15 cases, depending on how complex they are.
And for those cases that you're looking in, those 8 to 12 cases that you're sort of mourning of work that you're looking into, what sort of things are you looking at? For those who don't know much about the medical examiner role and why it's come in, what is it that you're looking for?
So obviously the main remit is to improve the accuracy of the medical certificate as the cause of death, which obviously there's quite a wide variation in. There's also the other sort of primary function is to allow the people who cared for that patient, in the community and their families, particularly the families, the friends, the person who's designated to be the next of kin, they have a voice in in the procedure, so they can raise concerns or give positive feedback, or so everybody who dies has a next of kin designated. Sometimes it's a social worker if there's nobody else, but usually it's a friend or family member, and the medical examiner office contacts each of those to talk through the cause of death that's documented on the certificate and to give them the opportunity to, raise any concerns, or, as I say, usually give quite positive feedback about the care the patient has received. And the other thing is that if we identify something that should go to the coroner, we make that referral directly.
And how much liaison do you tend to have with GPs? So obviously GPs are very used to doing death certificates historically, but this is a new statutory role and someone else in between them and the registrar and the relatives. How often do you end up sort of liaising, changing things, things becoming a bit more complex?
It can happen. I mean, most of the time the death certificates are absolutely fine, no problems at all. The care has been, appropriate and timely and, properly delivered. So there's very, very rarely any cause for concern. Sometimes I think because in GP we haven't really got time to go through the whole chronology of a patient's life, essentially, they might miss something that's relevant, not necessarily directly to the cause of death, but as a contributory factor. So, sometimes we'll add things. We are trying to get the terminology in line with what the Office of National Statistics has asked us to do. So, just to make it a bit more accurate, because the data is so important around death. And we don't want to make mistakes, but we don't want to miss important facts. I mean, in the press recently, there was reports that had come out about missing data related to drug deaths, opioid-related deaths that were obviously, referred to the coroner, and then wasn't documented on the death certificate. So there is probably quite a lot of underreporting of certain types of deaths, and obviously death rates and mortality does impact on funding for services. So for drug treatment services, obviously, if you're saying, well, only so many people died in the UK from an opioid related death, you know, then the funding does follow to try and prevent those deaths. So there might be underreporting in some areas. It's not always possible to say this is the definite cause of death. It's always to the best of your knowledge and belief, essentially, or, a bit like the Queen's death certificate, it said frailty of old age. That's fine. it's not always possible to pin it down to one thing.
Yeah. So it's sort of there's public health implications. That's the sort of importance of recording things and labelling things the right way.
Yeah.
But also that's interesting that there's a sort of knock-on effect with funding and service delivery that comes down the line from it as well.
And obviously there's a time lag for that because the data all feeds into the Office of National Statistics and they produce, endless reams of reports and things. But obviously, if the data they're producing the reports in is not accurate, then the reports can't be accurate, and then planning can be, funding might be less than it needs to be, or more than it needs to be, I guess. With the going back to asking about how we communicate with GPs, I think each medical examiner service may be doing it slightly differently. In Bristol, we're very lucky that all our practices in our ICB footprint have the same IT system, so that definitely helps. And the medical examiner service in the community has the same IT system, so once we receive the referral from the practice, we can access the IT system and see the notes directly. I can also obviously see all the hospital notes, by and large. and look through connecting care and all that. So it is a very bigger, much broader overview of the patient's care than the GP might even have. Definitely, usually more than the hospital has, because they don't know really what happened in the community. So it is quite interesting. If there is anything that needs to change, we go back and with a task through the IT system, through the clinical system, EMIS, and say, we suggest this and this is the reason why. And then they can come back saying, I don't agree, or yes, all right, I'll change it, or, oh, that's interesting, thank you for the information. And then the death certificate gets either rewritten or amended. Sometimes we do save GPs quite a lot of missed things, because on the new death certificate, if anybody's seen it, there are a few boxes that have to be ticked. So you have to say whether the person was pregnant or not, even if they're 95, which is quite annoying. The ethnicity, obviously ethnicity data is being included for the first time. So that's also quite important. And those are the areas where even as a busy GP, you might just not forget to tick or sign that box, and we can pick that up before it gets to the registrar, because in the past I've had this myself, it would usually be the family at that point ringing, say the death certificate is wrong, and then obviously there's trauma, and people get very upset about it. So we do try to make sure that before it leaves our office, which is the last step before it gets to the registrar, everything is accurate, filled out, ready to go, so there isn't any to-ing and fro-ing for the GP or the family after that point.
And do you tend to do your medical examiner role from your practice, or is there an office? How linked are you with the secondary care medical examiners? How does it sort of structured in the community?
We have to be independent. So I don't think anybody works out of their own practice. We have a community office, not far from where I live. And then each hospital in our region, of which there are three, has an office based in the hospital. So we've got four offices altogether. I go into the office. Some people do it remotely, but not always. It's quite flexible for many people, depending on, their other commitments and that sort of thing. But as a medical examiner, you have to be independent from the person's care, so you can't have been involved in their care at all. So I wouldn't scrutinize any deaths that were referred by my practice. My colleagues would do it in the hospital. If one of the consultants is a medical examiner, they wouldn't scrutinize their deaths either, so that you're fully independent.
That's really interesting to know. And it's just a really interesting role. It sounds very much a sort of quality assurance checking process, and you having that sort of broader view on things, and also really, hoping to make sure everything's nice and neat and tidy and all done accurately before it goes on to the next stage.
I mean, I've always had the view that the last thing we're ever going to do for our patient is complete their death certificate. So I consider it to be quite important. So, I've always had that view, and I suppose that's kind of influenced me a little bit into coming into the medical examiner role. But yes, I think it's not purely about being, arguing about terminology. Sometimes it might not make sense, but by and large, it's either because the Office of National Statistics have asked us that you write it in a certain way, rather than we're forcing you to change one word just because we have the power to do that. That's we don't have the power to do that anyway. As the attending practitioner, your view is the last view. it is about quality assurance, as you say, and giving a voice to the next of kin, essentially.
So that really nicely segues into my next question, which is about how you got into it. So clearly you've got a passion for making sure that this is really done properly, and that it's a service that we're offering back to the patient to make sure everything's accurately recorded. And that's a really nice way of thinking about it. But how did you come to be a medical examiner?
Well, I've always been comfortable with the care of the dying, and not everybody is, I suppose, but I've always considered it a privilege and, a very important part of a GP or doctor's role. Particularly in a GP practice, you're going likely to be having an ongoing relationship with the bereaved family. It's not as if you may never see these people again. So it is, I think, all part of the patient journey, that this is the last step of their journey, and for the people remaining behind, we want to make sure that everything goes as smoothly and as accurately as possible. I also enjoy the tiny details of people's lives. So going, having that time and being able to go back, you know, pretty much to birth for many people and looking at what's happened over their lives, I find very interesting, very enjoying. I'm the sort of doctor who goes back and looks at the paper notes when I can, you know, the very old-fashioned notes that are always in the file, in the archive somewhere. So that's quite, you know, satisfying to me. Again, not everybody might like that, but it's something that I do enjoy. I'm also very interested in the sort of, well, not the science, because I don't consider myself to be that type of doctor, but the diagnostic pathway and, you know, that sort of thing, the process from when you get the diagnosis to what happens to you afterwards. Yeah.
So you're clearly somebody who, as you say, comfortable with the end of people's lives, comfortable with being very sort of attention to detail in terms of checking things and making sure that we're not missing things. But how did you come to have the role? Was it an application process, or was it something that, you know, evolved from something else you were doing? Because I know it's a relatively new thing, isn't it?
Yes. I think I heard about the medical examiner role. Obviously, it was put forward after things like Harold Shipman and the Mid-Staffs hospitals, sort of, you know, where deaths were sort of covered up and, it, you know, things were, you know, not as they should have been, to put it mildly. And there were a number of inquiries after that. And then the recommendation from those inquiries, and I think, you know, the last one was probably about 20 years ago, was that there should be independent scrutiny. So somebody who's not been involved in the patient's care at all should have sight of the records separate to the coronial system, because obviously the coroner has always been there in England and Wales. So, it was for everybody who's not being scrutinised by a coroner, the independent scrutiny was recommended. And it's just taken an awfully long time to get the law and the service and everything up and running, which obviously became statutory on the 9th of September last year. But many areas, and particularly in Bristol, had been starting to do that in the secondary care trusts for a number. I think Bristol had been doing it for about 5 years at this point. And obviously when I started, it was in the hospital. So I probably heard about that, here comes the medical examiner service officially in the early, just after COVID. I might have had a bit more time to scroll through chat boards and Facebook and that sort of thing when we were all sitting at home, and saw it there, thought, oh, that looks interesting. I emailed the ME for the Southwest, and she put me in touch with the local lead ME, and then, you know, it went from there. But the training is all e-learning for health. It's on that platform. There's, I think, 26 modules you've got to do. They're quite legislation heavy. I'd encourage people to have a little look at them and see what they make of them before they consider the role, because you have to get through it. But there's no exam, as in, you know, there's no sort of OSCE or AKT or anything like that. And then there's an interview process. Part of the training also involves a course which is delivered by the Royal College of Pathology, who are sort of the our college for medical examiners. And they call it an in-person training day, but it's a one-day sort of training event, which has been virtual, I think, the last couple of years. So those are the two requirements, and that's what I had to do before I applied for the job. But then it was an interview process, and I was appointed after that.
So that's really useful sort of for people to know up front. So the process is you apply for a job, interview for it. If you get it, the expectation is you then do these modules and the training day.
I think it would be the other way around. They would want you to have done it before you applied. Because I suppose if they're looking to fill a post, they'd be wanting somebody to start straight away. So I think the online modules you need to do ahead of time, and then there's a commitment that you will do the in-person, the one-day training from the Royal College, within a certain number of months. I suppose that would vary depending on what your area's process is. So each medical examiner area has probably a slightly different way of doing it, but you've got to do the online modules before you apply.
And is it reasonably clear if people are sitting there thinking, oh, that really plays to my strengths. I like attention to detail and making sure death certificates are right. Is it fairly transparent in terms of which modules and requirements and things that you might need to do?
There is a folder that's medical examiner. And I think there's one for medical examiner officers as well, but obviously these would be medical examiners. And it's 26 modules, a bit like, I don't know if you're in your area, you do your CPD for GP, you know, your statutory mandatory training. We do it through e-learning for health in our practice. So that it's all on the same platform, which is quite good because I'm quite familiar with that one.
And are there any sort of useful skills or experiences you think that you had or it would be useful for others to get before they embarked on what could be quite a big time commitment in terms of modules on the off chance that they might then get a medical examiner role at the end of it?
Not really. I think once people are in the role, there might not be a lot of turnover. You might want to have an informal talk with the lead ME for your area to say, well, you know, what are there any posts coming up? I mean, they did advertise on NHS jobs when I applied, but I haven't really seen any other any other jobs in our region lately, because it's, you know, it's, I think it's quite popular, and I would definitely probably check ahead of time when they think they might have another vacancy. I'm not aware of a locum service for medical examiners. We certainly haven't had to use those in Bristol. There might be in other areas. I would definitely probably start with an informal email to the lead medical examiner of your ICB or your area, just to introduce yourself and say, oh, I'm interested, you know, what should I do next, sort of thing. I don't think necessarily I would commit to 10 hours of online learning on spec, if you know what I mean. It might make you a more attractive candidate it will make you a more attractive candidate, because most people would have that requirement before you apply. But I wouldn't do it if there wasn't going to be a job in my area, you know, for a year or two. That would seem a bit silly. They haven't updated them since the service went statutory last year, but they might change, I suppose, over time as well. So you want to do them when you're ready to start looking, or when you think you might get into a job. Yeah.
That's really helpful to think about timelines for these things as well. So thinking about where the jobs might be and who the relevant people are in your area, then making sure you've got the relevant training and then applying when the jobs and being ready to apply when they come out. That's really helpful, because I think it's one of those things that unless you've talked to someone who's done it, it's difficult to know what order to do things in.
I mean, a big plus is the training is free because it's on e-learning for health. So, you know, you have to do it in your own time, obviously. So it might take you away from other work. And there is no exit exam. So I think I probably would have gone for the, if there was an exam, I probably would have gone through it. But I last did an exam quite a few years ago. I'm an older GP. So the idea of sitting something quite stressful might put some people off. But so I could reassure that there is no exam at this point.
Is there any built-in sort of training on the job or quality assurance of what you're doing on the job or something around the team aspect to it?
So in the role, similar to any role, there's ongoing CPD. So we have a monthly CPD meeting. Our lead ME does an appraisal every year, which is, it's obviously relatively light touch because I'm only one session a week. So I don't have to, I can't attend all the meetings anyway, but I read the minutes. I go on to the Royal College of Pathology ME part of their website because they have a lot of ongoing information and updates. The quality assurance part is mainly via discussion. So, you know, recently I agreed a certificate, and then one of my colleagues who happens to be a gastroenterologist said, oh, actually, you know, that doesn't look quite right. And I was like, oh gosh, thank you. So we changed it and we went back to the doctor and that we changed the certificate again. So it is an ongoing learning process like any job really in this field. And we try for consistency, and we, you know, all our data does get sort of monitored by the lead ME and the lead medical examiner officer. But, you know, it is quite a collegiate way of working, even though we're not seeing each other very frequently because we're sort of work different days of the week. We send messages. There's a WhatsApp group. There's, quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, which is nice.
That sounds really nice, to have that sort of support structure around it as well. What would you say are the main benefits to you in terms of how it enhances your role as a GP, or the benefits you find of having that extra sort of portfolio work alongside your clinical work?
Well, I thankfully wasn't particularly, we were, because of my interest, my practice, we're one of the pilot practices in the, so before it went statutory. So we had all the processes well embedded. So it definitely made, well, I hope everybody would agree, it made us a little bit easier in our practice. And we did a lot of work. The team did a lot of work going out to practices, explaining, going to meetings, and trying to reassure people that, we're going to try and make this as seamless as possible. And the GP work stream, we had as GPs, myself and my other GP medical examiner colleagues had a lot of input into the design of the service, which in our area I think has made it a lot easier to engage with people, with the practices. It's an interesting one because as a doctor, I think if you think about how things enhance your practice, obviously because I'm looking at everybody's notes, well, not everybody's notes, but I'm looking at different patients' notes. I've got a lot more awareness of, now having been out of hospital jobs for many years, what actually happens in hospitals, the treatments for, the oncology service. There's more and more and more development. There's more treatments. So I've got more awareness of the types of treatments that my patients who I'm caring for as a GP might be going through. So I have, quite a bit of knowledge and can support people a bit better there. I've had to develop quite a more skills in drug interactions. How things can negatively impact on people, and I think it does just mean that you're probably a little bit more confident, maybe in dealing with secondary care as well, because you kind of sit between both. And I've enjoyed obviously having my medical examiner colleagues who come from various specialties, having their input and their viewpoints is very nice as well.
That's really nice, actually. I hadn't thought about it as a job that really works across being able to see notes in the hospital and colleagues around the hospital. It's almost like it's giant MDT, isn't it, for
Yes, yeah, definitely.
although not that multidisciplinary from the job role
No,
point
it
of
was a
view, but the
mortality
background.
morbidity meeting. Yeah, that
Yeah.
sort of thing. And I think as GPs, we're a little bit, obviously we have our own in-house meetings, end of life registers, that sort of thing. But we are at that point, we're at the end of the pathway, so we don't always know what's happened to the patient to the point that they've been discharged from oncology, and unfortunately there's nothing more to be done, and we're taking over their care, or hospice is taking over their care. So it is very interesting to sit with the notes essentially and be able to sort of plot out that timeline, which is the way I approach my job. Is I go back to the point of diagnosis, and I go back even further, and then you sort of plot, what's happened to the patient since. And yeah, because there's so many different in our area, I think obviously we've got a gastroenterologist, endocrinologist, ITU, A&D. I don't want to miss anybody out because there'll be cross surgeons, and GPs, and hope I haven't forgotten anybody. But it is, quite a broad range of people. Oh, and palliative care doctors. So people work in different places, different hospitals, and it's very, very nice to have that, as you say, sort of, well, it's not multidisciplinary, but broader team around you. Although it is all sort of virtual, but it is there.
Are there any downsides you think about being a GP who's also a medical examiner, or things that you would sort of caveat or warn people against before jumping on that journey?
I think you have to have quite a philosophical attitude to life. Because you can you can see things that are happening to all sorts of people. Obviously, the vast majority of people in the UK die in later life, but younger people do also die. And you can, I think, develop a little bit of paranoia about your own health and possibly the health of your family members, people around you. But I think that's true for maybe doctors in general, but it definitely would be enhanced by being a medical examiner because you will see the very rare cases of very young people dying of cancer, for example, and then they die in the community. I think, that works both ways because you also see the massive good the NHS does and, everything that the large system is delivering to our population. You could see all of it, and by and large, it's very good, sort of good care. So that's a positive, but the awareness of random things happening, if you're not quite philosophical about life, could be a little bit difficult.
I think, yeah, it's always interesting to see the different exposures you have to different aspects of people's life as a GP. But as you say, you're getting a sort of a concentrated version of the end
Yes,
of life, aren't you?
distilled,
If you're
distilled. And I think, particularly when death rates are higher, so over the winter when we've got a lot of respiratory illness, it can also be not monotonous, but a little bit repetitive because obviously the vast majority of people, as they die at home or in a care home, in later life, and with nothing, specific that's happened, they've just gradually sort of slowed down and died. So those kind of cases, we still do a full scrutiny of, but they can become a bit repetitive in January, February, when the death rates from respiratory illness are higher in the community.
I think you've given a really helpful summary of sort of pathways into this and sort of the process and how you get involved in it. But is there anything you want to add in terms of people sat there thinking, actually, this really, I hadn't thought about this role before, but it sounds really interesting. Maybe I'll go and find out who my local or regional ME is. Are there any other sort of hints or tips or signposting you would suggest people look at if they're really enthusiastic and want to get involved?
I would say that just to bear in mind two things is that there's no direct patient care. So if that's your main satisfaction from your day job, this might not be the job for you. It's very much clinical governance, note documentation, that sort of thing. So if that's not part of what you enjoy of being a doctor, you might not enjoy this job. It's an intellectual challenge, but the focus is not on clinical decision making in any way, because the decision making has already happened. It's not something that you have control of. So if you're a GP or hospital doctor who likes to, be direct patient care and, clinical decision making are your main sort of satisfactions in your job, this is probably not the one for you. I think if you're looking to get into the role, as I say, just email or contact the ME office in your area and have an informal chat. You might want to spend an hour or two in the office. I mean, there's not a lot to see, but you can come and just get a feel for how it works. And the website from the Royal College of Pathology, the medical examiner bit, has a lot of details about the job description, the attributes, and how it broadly speaking will work. Each area will probably have a slightly different administrative side and IT system. So, I think I'm not sure if I could work as an ME in a different area because I'm very familiar with the IT in my area, but that might not be the case for other people. And each ME service should have a little section on the ICB website. So if that's what you if you wanted their phone number, for example, that's where you'd probably find it. I mean, your admin team in your practice should have their contact details as well, because we've been doing the service for a year now. Hopefully, the comms have gone out to everybody.
And are there any networks or conferences or things that side of things or focus groups, special interest groups around this area?
Within the medical examiner service, like in any group of medics, there are people that do enjoy different things. So we have in our service an ITU consultant who is very much focused and done research on verifying the verifying deaths, and so he's very interested in that. But that's slightly more technical and sort of more hospital based. I suppose you could focus on sort of safety if you wanted to do specific work streams within the National Medical Examiner Service. There are different people looking at different areas of the work. I'm not involved in any of those, so I don't have different details for it. I'm you can be the lead ME for your region, so there is a bit of career progression, and then there's national MEs as well. So that's not the part of the job that interests me particularly. There's an annual conference which is hosted by produced by the Royal College of Pathology. Obviously you can attend that, you have to pay for it. It might not be something that would be too interesting for somebody who's not already a medical examiner. A membership of the college allows you to access their educational materials. The conference this year was very interesting because we had a bit of information and a lot of discussion and a presentation on the assisted dying bill. And so that's quite an interesting part of legislation and potential change for the future that might be coming up. So that is quite interesting. And in Bristol, we sort of, we all came together to watch the conference rather than sit in our own houses, because it was virtual. So we, so we had a sort of away day attending the conference virtually, but all together. So that was really, really nice. Networking outside of Bristol, I've not really been involved in, but, other colleagues do, liaise with the medical examiners over in Wales. The medical examiner offices are our admin support team, who are brilliant. They, have links with all the other ME offices in our region, so the Southwest and Wales. So
awesome. That's really great to know, and where people can kind of look for further information. I certainly feel inspired. It's a role that I'd never really thought about, but that sort of attention to detail. And I really like what you said about being able to learn from what's happened in patient journeys, the hospital side of things as well, and gives you that better insight and understanding of what your patients are going through when you're not directly looking after them in the community. That's a benefit I'd never really thought of, and I'm sure it will trigger with others around, maybe this could be something that I could do. And it sounds like it fits very nicely, a complementary role to your GP partnership, but also, quite a succinct role that happens one session a week, and then you do the clinical stuff the other side. So thank you very much for sharing your insights on it. We're asking everybody to end with their highlight or best moment in their extended role. So can you tell us yours?
Thankfully, they're not too dramatic highs or lows yet. It's not much like a television series I used to watch when I was a child. I'm giving away my age here, which was called Quincy ME, Quincy the Medical Examiner, which is based in America. So it's not like that, but it is a very good job. I enjoy it massively. I have been involved in cases where there have been safety concerns and further harm has been prevented, but I've not been doing the job that long, so most of these are still going through clinical governance and inquests and that sort of thing, so I can't really specify specific cases, but it is a very intellectually satisfying and I think emotionally satisfying as well, because if you can try and get things right for the future as well, it's quite good. And helping the system learn can only benefit all of us in the end. We're all going to need care at some point in our lives. So hopefully it all feeds in and there'll be knock-on effects in years to come. So I enjoy that part of it as well. I would definitely say if you're curious about it, I'd highly encourage you to look into it. It's very satisfying, very different from day-to-day GP, has its own sort of challenges, but they, I don't count it as stressful as being a GP, so it's quite nice to have that one day a week of relative calm, although in winter it doesn't feel very calm. And well, that's true in GP as well. So I would definitely start just by looking at the Royal College of Pathology website or contacting your local ME office and see where it takes you.
Perfect. What a nice note to end on. And I come back to what you said about the public health implications and the funding.
Yes.
It's so difficult, isn't it, that some interactions we have, you never quite know the benefits that it comes down the line, and it's difficult to qualify and quantify that. But it's a really nice way to think about it, that broader overview that you have has such big potential public health implications and funding down the line. And obviously it's in its infancy, so it's really interesting to hear about your experiences. And yeah, I look forward to seeing where the role goes and where the GP fits in and where we go from here. So thank you very much for giving up your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
We hope that this careers podcast has motivated and inspired you to explore the variety of career options available as a GP. Speak to your appraiser, your local training programme directors, or perhaps join our RCGP mentoring programme for further support to diversify your career. Thanks for listening and good luck.
The GP Plus Careers Podcast.